Hi, everyone. My name is Paul Weber, and on behalf of my colleague, Dr. Syed Zatar of the University of Ottawa, I would like to welcome everyone to the teleclass, Bacterial Typing Methods and Their Value in Infection Control. This teleclass topic is a late addition, actually, to the teleclass schedule this year. And although most of this year's teleclasses were booked in 2003, I do always reserve the right to add to the schedule from time to time when I think it's appropriate. In this case, I believe that it was not only appropriate, I believe that it was necessary. I had approached Dr. Giles Edwards about giving another teleclass topic, but after we spoke for a while about the practical usefulness and limitations of laboratory bacterial typing in surveillance and control of infectious disease, it became obvious, to me at least, that this was a very important piece of information and that it needed to be shared. And in my case, it needed to be shared in a teleclass. As you can see on the title slide, Dr. Edwards is a consultant microbiologist with the Scottish MRSA Reference Laboratory, and it is a great honor to have him present this teleclass today. So to present Bacterial Typing Methods and Their Value in Infection Control, from Glasgow, Scotland, I am pleased to present Dr. Giles Edwards. Giles.
Thank you very much. If we go straight on to my second slide, I've numbered the slides in the bottom left-hand corner, so you should be able to, I should be able to make sure you're on the same one as I am. It is my intention in this hour or so to illustrate a range of microbial typing methods, but I'm not going to concentrate, as one often does in talking about typing methods, on the technical issues, the problems, the theoretical basis, but I'm going to concentrate on the kind of information that gets out and how useful it is in routine infection control. And I don't just mean the day-to-day business of controlling infection on ward, identifying outbreaks and doing our best to control them, but also the longer-term planning which is involved in keeping an eye on what's going on countrywide and even worldwide. Obviously, I'm going to draw the examples from my own experience, which is based, as Paul said, in Scotland, because Scotland, as most of you will know, is only a small part of Britain. It accounts for about 10% of the population, though a bit more of that in area. And my own experience is largely, though far from exclusively, about MRSA. As I said, I'm a director of the Scottish MRSA Reference Laboratory. So this is very much a personal account from my own experience. But I should point out, I think, at this stage that I'm not just working in the reference laboratory. I'm also the infection control doctor for the hospital I work in. And I do see the way these techniques are used from day to day on the wards, and I can think a lot about how we could be improving them, how we could be providing more useful information. I intend to do this by talking first a bit about the background of MRSA in Scotland. My original intention was to try and get this sort of background history of MRSA in Scotland to emerge out of the examples I was going to give, but I decided that was perhaps too ambitious a task, and I think I will precede the main topic of my teleclass with a small section on the history of MRSA, particularly in Scotland and particularly in relation to elsewhere in the world. And this should illustrate the kind of problems which we particularly incur and which we obviously have to try and solve. Having done that, I shall say what I think infection control practitioners want out of typing methods, both in controlling outbreaks in the short term and more long-term surveillance and planning. I shall then go on to the main subject of my talk, which is about typing methods. What kind of information can they provide? What different typing methods do provide? And finish up with some final comments, not so much conclusions as comments about things which may not have emerged during the course of the talk. So to begin with, the background to MRSA in Scotland. I should start off by saying that the situation in Scotland is very similar to that in the rest of Britain, much closer to that than to other parts of Europe. Europe itself, as many of you will know, having quite a wide range of experience. If you go back to my first involvement with MRSA in Scotland, which was well before 1990, MRSA was not on the whole seen as a serious problem. It was interesting to microbiologists, but it didn't cause serious clinical problems, and it seemed, generally speaking, controllable as an infection control risk. If you had a patient with MRSA admitted to your wards and did happen occasionally, then you put into place standard infection control procedures, and on the whole, it didn't spread very much. Some hospitals looked more closely at some areas. In the hospital I was working at the time in Glasgow, we kept quite a close eye on burns units and the dermatology unit, because that was where most of the strains were. And I know that some other doctors and other microbiologists in other parts of Scotland were also doing some investigation of MRSAs locally. But in fact, it was very difficult for us to compare what we were seeing in Glasgow with what other people were doing elsewhere in Scotland, because the typing methods are so limited that we couldn't actually tell whether we were dealing with the same strain, or at least not at all easily. So that was the situation before 1990. And moving on to the fifth slide, this graph just shows the number of isolates reported from Scottish diagnostic laboratories to the Scottish Centre for Infection and Environmental Health in two successive five-year periods, the late 80s and the early 90s. You can see in the front row of columns that in the late 80s there was only one health board area of the 11 which existed then, from which a significant number of MRSAs were being produced. And even that was only about 400 over a period of 5 years. And all the other health boards, even the ones with more than minimum F, J, and K in that graph, were still producing very small numbers. The situation had changed substantially in the early 1990s. And although health board area G, the one I was working in, is still the biggest, still had the highest number of isolates, it is substantially, it is far less dramatic difference from one to other health boards, J, F, and so on, in that graph. To look at this, what was going on in that in the early 90s in a bit more detail, I'll go on to the next slide, slide 6, which shows one particular hospital, the one I was actually working at the time, and looking at the actual numbers of strains over that slightly longer period, fairly low in the late 1980s, increasing substantially in 1991-92, tailing off slightly, and then suddenly increasing to when 1996, and it went on increasing. The reason I think this is quite interesting, although it is very localized data, is that I know from talking to other people that similar patterns were seen in other hospitals in Glasgow and indeed over the whole of Scotland at the time, that slight increase, that significant but small increase in the early 90s, a slight tailing off, followed by a big increase. And because I was actually doing the typing there myself, I do know roughly what was going on in this one hospital. And before 1990, the strains we were seeing were strains which had been around for some time, which we recognized, though we didn't know a great deal about them, but we could actually see that they weren't changing very much. In late 1990, a strain was introduced from Southern Europe, and a hospital patient who'd been in hospital in Southern Europe and then was admitted to hospital in Glasgow, and this strain spread quite widely throughout several hospitals in Glasgow, and particularly good at spreading on surgical wards and to some extent in intensive care units. But we seemed, I think, we began to learn how to control it, and in 1993 and 94, I think there was evidence that things were getting slight, that we were able to control it to some extent. And then things got out of control in 1996, and this was due to the introduction of a new strain. And on the next slide again, we show what happened after 1996. The small increases I've been talking about in the early 90s become very small compared to what happened between 1997 and about 2002, the numbers went up dramatically, up to about 12,000 the whole of Scotland over a year. But certainly a tenfold increase over no more than 10 years. Though there is some evidence that maybe it's beginning to level out now. I've included in that slide the number of isolates which are actually sent by laboratories in Scotland to the reference laboratory, and those are the bars, the columns in red. And I include that merely so that I can tell the typing data I'm going to mention to you is based on a substantial proportion of the total isolates that were around. Although it wasn't a particularly well-selected subset of strains, it was so big that it does give us a fair idea of what was actually going on. We go on to the next slide. This just illustrates that the problem it was a genuine clinical problem. These are isolates, again, reported to the Scottish Centre for Infection and Environmental Health, which were isolated from blood cultures in Scotland during successive years, and that showed a parallel increase in the late 1990s and perhaps the slight tailing off just recently. The next slide again shows the typing data on those strains over a five-year period, over the period from the time the reference body has been in existence, that is since 1997. And one thing it shows very dramatically is that two strains, EMRSA15 and EMRSA16, account for more than 90% of the total isolates we have been referred to the Scottish Reference Laboratory in that time. And these are the strains which clearly were responsible for the big increase in MRSA. And if you look at the yellow marker, the other strains, they've actually stayed very constant right all the way along at only a few hundred every year. If we go on again, obviously if you get two very predominant strains, it's interesting to know if there's any variation within them, if the subtypes vary. And indeed, what I've got here is a breakdown of these two big strains, EMRSA50 and EMRSA16, which had previously became prominent in England before they came to Scotland. A breakdown into pulse field gel electrophoresis subtypes. I shall be saying a bit more about pulse field gel electrophoresis as a typing method later on. What I want to point out here is that it is one of the most discriminating typing methods, and if you can't subdivide things by pulse field, you probably can't subdivide them at all, again, with certain exceptions I shall come to. But more than just about half the MRSA15s have a single pulse field pattern. In other words, you can't tell one from the other by standard genotyping methods, And if you take the five commonest patterns of the MRSA15, then that accounts for 90% of the strains we've seen. That is 90% of getting on for 50,000 isolates over a 7 or 8 year period. And there's a similar pattern seen with EMRSA16, not quite so dramatic. There is more variation here, but 35% of the EMRSA16s have the single commonest pattern, and 80% of them have one of the five patterns. I said I would just set this in a European and a worldwide context. The data in this slide compares from different countries in Europe the proportion of blood culture isolates of Staph aureus which are MRSA. In some of the northern and Scandinavian countries, then the numbers are quite low. They come down to about less than 3%. In places like Britain, France, Italy, Greece, on that map, it goes above 30%, and it's quite variable. On a worldwide basis, the data in the year's data is collected in a fairly standardized way. The number of hospitals contributing to this in different countries does vary somewhat, so it isn't absolutely standardized. But it is collected in a standardized way, and so it's probably quite meaningful. If you try and get similar data on a worldwide basis, it's much more difficult to find things which are genuinely comparable. Now, this graph number 12, this picture number 12, slide 12, shows some figures I've just picked out from the literature, which do show that there's a good deal of variation worldwide, though, and there are one or two places, particularly in the Far East, which have higher figures than the UK, than the worst parts of Europe or the highest parts of Europe, but there aren't many places which have lower numbers than the most well-controlled parts of Europe. I don't want to put too much weight on that data. So it's collected from a number of different sources, and in fact, at a number of different times. So I will now move on to the second part of what I plan to do, and try and give an idea of what I think people who control infection want from typing. And this it takes me to slide number 13. And I divide this, the kind of situations in which infection control people might be helped by typing, into two areas. And the first one is investigating an outbreak. And the question which was wanted, needs an answer is this an outbreak? And I translate that into the question, are these isolates part of a group with a recent common ancestor? Now, that is a perhaps not very well-defined term, but it is as close as you can get to anything useful, I think. The term recent, obviously, can have different interpretations, but it is, if strains have a recent common ancestor, then you can consider them part of a group which are likely to have been transmitted together or from a single source. The second question, how common are such strains in the background population? If I see 3 or 4 strains on a single ward, which are the pattern I referred to earlier, Passfield pattern 15A, then I know that those strains are very common in Scotland, and I've no particular reason to believe that they result from a recent episode of cross-infection. The patients could have independently brought them into the hospital. Whereas if it was a very unusual strain, then I'm far more likely to think there's something in the way of transmission on the ward going on. The other thing which infection control people want me to answer is there anything unusual about this strain? It's probably been drawn to their attention not just by the numbers, but by the fact that it may be causing serious infections. So the question, is there anything unusual about these strains? Are they particularly pathogenic or particularly transmissible? Is often asked. It's actually quite difficult to answer, but it's something which a typing method should, ideally, be able to shed some light on. And the other question, which of course always come up, is how soon can you give me an answer to this question? Because I, the infection control person, have to do at least something today. And I should emphasize this in the same way as I emphasized the question of the recent common ancestor, because it is important, and it may often be valuable to have some useful information, if limited useful information today, rather than have to wait a week to get a definitive answer, because by that time you're doing quite a different kind of infection control exercise. And the other thing which I'm frequently asked is, what do these results mean? It's very important that people like me, that people like us in the reference laboratories, can put the results in a form which other people can get some idea as to what they mean. If we're looking, again, on the next slide, for what is needed for surveillance and planning, the questions are concerned with the significance of the changing numbers. If, over a period of a few years, the numbers of strains on a particular ward or over months is going up, then the question which I'm asked is, are these just increasing numbers of the same strains, or are they different strains, strains with different characteristics, strains which maybe have increased pathogenicity or increased transmissibility? Also, people want to know, how do these isolates compare with those from other places? And the subtext there is, are other places better at controlling them? Have they actually had the chance to try and control these strains, and have they got anywhere with it? Again, the questions about giving me the results yesterday and explaining what the results mean arise here again, but they tend to be less urgent in this particular size, in this particular area. If we go on to the next sort of section, is what kind of information can it reasonably expect typing to supply? Now, what a type method is doing is actually showing how similar two isolates are. And the different typing methods will be looking at different characteristics, different characters. And there are a huge range of characters which can be examined. And the significance of the difference between the strains depends to some extent, to a large extent, on what range of characters, what characters you're actually using in your typing method. And the significance of these differences has to be understood, at least by the people who are applying a typing method. And again, the significance of the differences needs to be clearly expressed to the people who are actually using the results. The other question, again, which typing methods can supply, can give an answer to, is the relationship of the strains which we're typing to other strains. This is only true if the strains we're comparing them with are recognizable by the typing method which we're using, and it's only useful if they have known characteristics which we can then apply our knowledge of to the new strains. So that's some very general remarks about typing. If we go on to the next slide, I'm putting a few more general comments about these things. If you have a typing method, what questions should you be asking about it? And the first question, I think, should be, how variable is the characteristic? How much does it vary between isolates? And what we're looking for here is not as much variation as possible or very little. We're looking for something in between the two. If there's too much variation between strains, you may find the strains which are in fact closely related look different. If there is too little, then we will not be able to distinguish between strains which actually their most recent common ancestor was actually rather a long time ago. And this point about discriminating, having the right degree of discrimination, and is something I shall come back to. I shall refer to quite often, because it's often the key to knowing which type of method to use in a particular situation, or the fine-tuning the particular type of method you're using. The second question, how much does the environment contribute to the variation? It's something which in practice is not a huge problem. The type of methods which survive long enough to be actually used and given, and the methods which survive long enough for the results to be given to infection control practitioners, have usually excluded the ones which are so variable that they're not very useful. So I think you can say of all the methods I shall describe, this is not usually a big problem. And since the methods we're using nowadays are quite different from, in many, many ways, those we were using even 10, 15 years ago, it's quite useful to know how the results correspond to other methods which have been used in the past. Now, it won't surprise you if I say that there are so many different methods to use that can be used that we couldn't possibly describe them all, but they do fall into two broad groups, the phenotypic and the genotypic. Again, I don't want to go into great amount of technical description here, and if you look in a dictionary, you'll see the phenotypic means the observable characteristics resulting from the genes and the environment. And the genotypic is looking at the DNA itself, and this is getting very close to the idea of the recent common ancestor, closer than phenotypic typing is. But under using standardized conditions, then phenotypic typing is often very useful. And this idea of standardization is another idea which I shall refer to again and again. I now want to describe a range of different phenotypic typing methods. But before I describe individual methods, I shall make a few general remarks about them. Phenotypic methods have been available for much longer than genotypic ones, and certainly as far back as my involvement in microbiology goes, there have been quite a wide range of them available. As a general rule, though not always, they quite well be quicker and more readily available than genotypic typing methods. I've already hinted that speed, getting some information quickly, may often be more useful than getting a definitive answer more slowly. It is certainly true that in order to interpret the results, to work out the significance, you need to know quite a lot about the organism itself. And you need to know what the characteristics of that organism are and that typing method within that organism. And three examples, each of which I shall say a little bit more about. Antibiotic resistance typing, this is applicable to many bacteria. Phage typing, which has been used quite widely in the past in Staph aureus and in Salmonella, and other organisms as well. And the third method, serotyping, probably 15 years ago, it was probably the predominant method of typing a lot of organisms, but it still had its place with Salmonella, with Neisseria, with Legionella, and other organisms. All these methods are probably to some extent being superseded by genetic methods, but they're still widely enough used for them to be worth saying something about. And going on to the next slide, number 18, I'll make a few general remarks about antibiotic resistance typing, which I think is probably a rather underused and underrated technique. It can be done in a routine laboratory, so it can be done quickly. A lot of other methods do involve sending isolates to reference laboratories. Now, working in a reference laboratory, I have no objection to that, but I have to recognize that it does add not only the time taking the organism there, getting the organism there, but also a lot of the culture purification, which has been done in the routine lab, is often repeated for good logistical reasons in the reference laboratory. So just sending an organism to a reference laboratory does slow things down, and speed may well be important. Some information on the resistance typing, that is, knowing which antibiotics the particular strains are sensitive to and which ones they're resistant to, is probably available anyway by the time an MRSA is recognized by a routine diagnostics lab. They may use a wide range of different methods for detecting the antibiogram or the antibody resistance pattern. But because this information is used for clinical purposes, it has to be the methods have to be comparable, and that is not a big problem. I think I probably rate antibody resistance typing quite highly because I know it can be very helpful for Staph aureus, and I'm particularly for MRSA, and I think what I say in the next few minutes should not be not think that can be automatically applied to all bacteria. In interpreting it, you need to know what the local patterns of resistance are, what the patterns of your local common strains are. I mean, for example, I know that if I measure the susceptibility of an MRSA to about 18 or 20 different antibiotics, I can almost certainly tell you which of the local common strains it is in Scotland. That information wouldn't be very useful to me if I went to a place where there were different common strains, but it is actually a useful method in a local situation. It's also often said that in order to interpret these patterns, you need to know some knowledge of the common resistance mechanisms, by which I mean more, not so much the ways in which the genes are transmitted into resistant antibiotic, but the ways in which the resistance mechanisms can be developed and transferred from strain to strain. Although I think that may not always be as helpful as some people think. Most microbiologists will tell you that fusidin resistance is very, very easily acquired by Staph aureus under treatment if a patient is being treated with fusidin. But that doesn't appear to stop fusidin resistance being a particularly good marker for quite a number of strains. I won't go into that in any more detail at the moment. So the antibiotic resistance typing can give you useful preliminary guidance as to what's going on. But there are two other points I'd like to mention before I move on, stating that occasionally you may detect different significant important differences which are not picked up by other available beta-borne genotyping methods. I've already pointed out that almost half the MRSA15s in Scotland have got exactly the same pulse phenotype. So that does not mean to say that they all have the same antibiogram. They don't. And it is often possible to follow a particular outbreak by looking at an unusual resistance feature of the strain, which is not reflected in its pulse field pattern. And this is particularly useful if you've got a localized outbreak and you want to do some local monitoring. Once the reference laboratory has done the original typing for you, then the local laboratory can then be informed what antibiotic resistance patterns to look out for and get results and identify new strains as part or not part of the outbreak very much more quickly. Certainly much more quickly than the reference laboratory could. The next slide is just an illustration of antibiotic resistance typing. Each picture there just shows a typical, rather old-fashioned way of measuring sensitivity to 18 different antibiotics. Also on those pictures, there is a small tube containing colored agar, and that illustrates something which I want to mention very briefly, which is biotyping. Now, the one which I've headed typical MRSA15 has a non-colored agar on it, and that's because that agar has been designed to demonstrate the presence of the enzyme urease. In the presence of, if a strain is capable of producing urease, it turns the agar pink, as it had on the MRSA16. It so happens that, say, the two common strains in Scotland, and indeed the whole of the UK, have distinctly different urease reactions. And that may well be something which is worth doing just as a quick way of saying whether a particular strain is part of an outbreak or not. I'll say a little bit more about biotyping in the next slide, number 20. These biotyping involves picking up biochemical differences between strains, and it has some of the advantages of antibiotic resistance typing in the conditions in that this can often be done in relatively small general laboratories and quite widely available. I think it's fair to say it's less often useful than antibiogram typing, but I've already pointed out that the urease in the British MRSA is an exception to that general rule. One of the reasons that is often not very useful is that the kind of tests which have been worked on and which are available in many laboratories are in fact combinations of a range of single tests developed not to identify subtypes, but actually to help the identification of species. And testing which distinguishes between species, say between Staph aureus and Staph epidermidis, may well not be very useful in identifying subtypes of Staph aureus. And just comment that, again, you need knowledge of local strains to interpret this. Now, with two single methods I want to say a bit more about, the first one is serotyping, and the next slide are perhaps the two most widely used phenotypic methods over the last few decades. Both serotyping and phenotyping are now beginning to be superseded by genotyping, but there's a long way to go before they're completely replaced. And I don't want to go into technical details about this. That's not what I'm trying to do this evening, or this afternoon, I suppose. So antibodies are produced to antigens which are different on different strains of the same organism, and a wide range of methods such as latent discrimination or enzyme-linked immunosorbent assays are used to find out which particular antigen is present on a particular isolate and then thereby to assign it to a group or a type. Once you've got, it's quite difficult, it's quite laborious to build up a set of appropriate antibodies in the first place. Once that's been done, the antibodies can be distributed to different laboratories, and that will enable different laboratories to carry out what is amounts to the same test in a very standardized way. the tests are fairly rapid, and by many methods you can do them the same. They can get a result the same day. And once they're set up, once antibodies are available, they're relatively cheap to carry out. If you're going to do a full set of full typing, getting as much information as is possible on a particular isolate, you need to get to somewhere which has got a wide range of antibodies, and that will normally be a reference laboratory, and that would incur the delay there, which I've already referred to. This technique is still used for, quite very widely used, for assigning salmonella to species, or as one we're supposed to call them now, serotypes. It's also used in Legionella and in other bacteria as well. I think that's probably all I need to say about phage typing. I will now go on, serotyping. I will now go on, slide 22, to phage typing. Now, most bacteria will be susceptible to some bacteriophages, and the susceptibility can be fairly easily shown, as in the plate illustrated on the right hand of this slide, by lytic plaques on agar plate cultures. What's been happening, the way that plate was repaired, was that the bacteria which were interested in typing was plated out over the whole of the plate, and then spots of about 27 different phages, suspensions of different phages, have been applied to it, and some phages which are capable of attacking that bacteria have produced lytic areas, clear areas. And what we're doing with phage typing is basically using a standard set of phages, a standard set of reagents, and producing a pattern of reactions. By examining bacteria on cultures, you can usually find phages if you know what you're doing, which are active against different strains. And you may need a strain's change over the years to use different sets of phages. But as I've already hinted, it's quite difficult to set up to get the phages. But once it's actually been set up, it's fairly quick and fairly cheap to run. So a few more comments about that. That although I said it's fairly quick and cheap to run, it does need very scrupulous attention to methodology and quality control. It's much less widely used than it used to be. It's still used sometimes. It's still used for subdividing some of the common salmonella serotypes, and until recently was quite widely used for Staph aureus, particularly for MRSAs, although it turned out to be less useful for MRSAs than for insensitive Staph aureus. The Scottish Reference Laboratory was using phage typing as part of its routine strain typing service until about 3 years ago, but we now have used more genotypic methods. One of the more difficult points about phage typing is how to tell people the results. As I've already hinted, what you've got is a pattern, a quite complicated pattern of reactions, and you need to be able to summarize that in a form which means something to the people who need the results. And there are two ways of doing it. One is just to produce a type number, say pattern 1, pattern 2, or type 1, type 2, and that is the way which is normally done with Salmonella. The habit of people working with Staph aureus was usually to provide a list of phage reactions such as that on the bottom line of slide 23, which really needs somebody who knows what's going on to help you interpret it. Moving on to the next slide, slide 24, I'm getting to the genotypic typing methods. Now, these are much more recently developed, although some of them do go back to the late 80s, or even earlier, some of them. More recently developed, and they're often more expensive to do, although that isn't always as clear-cut as you might expect. I think it's still fair to say at present that they're less readily available, although that may well change over the next few years as diagnostic microbiology maybe goes through the same sort of revolutions as other diagnostic laboratory methods went through some decades ago. And the methods on the whole usually take a little bit slower and take a little bit more time to perform and to get results from, even if if they're being done on the site where the organism was originally isolated. As with the phenotypic typing methods, working out the significance of what's going on does require experience specific to the organism, though because we're dealing with the DNA, the inherited material itself, it is perhaps interesting that one perhaps should believe that it may well be slightly more easy to apply general principles of how DNA varies, but that doesn't, but it certainly does have, you do need some knowledge of the specific organism. There are a very wide range of methods which have been used. They're chosen, so the one examples I've given are chosen from many. There's this phrase, YATM, which was produced a few years ago in a paper by Mark Artman, which is translates as yet another typing method. And it turns out in a laboratory which has experience in genetic method, it's very easy to produce yet another method, which your lab does, and in fact, but difficult to persuade anybody else to do it. And it's very useful, it may well be useful in analyzing your local outbreaks, but it doesn't play the same role as a widely used method does in allowing worldwide or even national assessment of what's going on. And in fact, I've written three methods down here. In fact, I left one out. I'm going to talk about four. Plasmid profiling, I shall mention briefly, it's one of the oldest methods, and it's still carried out occasionally. The one I missed out from this slide is the PCR-based methods. And I shall talk about restriction enzyme-based methods, which includes the pulse viongelefectoresis, which is probably the de facto standard for bacteriological typing nowadays. And I shall say a bit in the end about sequence-based methods, which have very great advantages, but which are not yet being very widely used. Plasmid profiling is the first one I can talk about, which actually you finish up. The end result of the process is that it's a photograph of a gel. And I shall have some more general remarks to make about analyzing gel patterns later on. But all I want to do here is illustrate that you can get that you get patterns on the gel, you get patterns, you get bands seen which vary from strain to strain. Each vertical column, if you like, corresponds to a single strain. This is actually not looking at the main part of the genotype of the organism's genome, but it's looking at the plasmids, the accessory DNA, which are more variable, which vary much more than the main chromosomal gene. Remember the main chromosomal genes, but which techniques to separate them out and look at them, and each individual band on that photograph will normally represent a single plasmid, and the position on the gel represents their size. So you will see in the middle of that gel there are three columns side by side which have the same single plasmid down towards the bottom of the photograph, and that indicates that those three strains, the strains which those were brought, were prepared, probably certainly have the same plasmid, the same single plasmid, and may well be closely related. The problem with this, not all clinical significant bacteria do have detectable plasmids, and plasmids, they're less stable than the other genotypic features, so that isn't necessarily a disadvantage. And I've already indicated that you need to choose your level of discrimination, the level, whether it's coarse or fine, depending on how much variation there is in the underlying population. And so sometimes the fact that you can get more variation with plasmids actually makes them more useful than some other methods. For example, in work which we also do in one of the labs I work in Glasgow, we do a lot of typing of Salmonella. And we do find sometimes strains which have the same pulse field type, same which are not well discriminated between by pulse field, may well have different plasmid profiles, which may be useful in identifying common strains. On the next slide, slide 26, I want to say something about PCR-based typing methods. And there are many variants of this. And the idea of this, again, the technical side is not particularly germane to what I want to say. It's basically using amplification of DNA by PCR with carefully chosen primers in order to get a set of bands on a gel which indicate which vary from strain to strain. One of the examples of one thing we've used quite a lot with Staph aureus is one called PCR rabotyping, although some people will say that what we were doing was not technically the same as what other people use the same phrase for. And we use this as an initial investigation to show that isolates are not closely related or that they are close enough related to need further investigation. This is, in fact, what I would describe as a fairly coarse typing method, in that many strains, whose recent common ancestry is quite a long time ago, may well have the same pattern. But if things have got different patterns, you can be fairly confident that they're not closely related. This is a fairly quick method. We can get a result probably in 24 hours, but for various reasons, it's quite difficult to standardize between laboratories. I shall show an example of a bit of that in not the next slide, but the slide after. But the next slide, I want to say something about restriction enzyme methods of typing, and in particular, pulse field gel electrophoresis. These methods do not use PCR. You extract the DNA using a standardized technique as you can and cut it into fragments using specific restriction enzymes, which cut in the DNA where it's got specific sequences of base pairs. And this will give you a characteristic pattern of fragment sizes, which will vary from not only from organism to organism, but also from strain to strain. There is a wide choice of enzymes available, most of them will be bought commercially. And basically, you tend to choose something either which cuts very frequently and which uses a large number of small fragments, or something which cuts far more seldom, produces a small number of large fragments. When these methods were first being developed 15 or so years ago, the small fragments were easier to handle because you could separate them on the kind of gel equipment which was readily available at the time. The large fragments needed special equipment, that is the pulse field gel electrophoresis equipment, in order to get useful separation. And since the pulse field gel electrophoresis equipment is not cheap, it was quite a long time before a large number of labs had enough equipment to be able to produce comparisons, useful comparisons. Because it's a fairly slow technique, but it has become almost the de facto standard for many organisms, including, say, E. coli 157, Staph aureus. And this is partly because a huge amount of work has been done in a lot of different labs and in central public health laboratories to standardize the way things are done, both the preparation of the DNA, the way it's cut, the choice of enzymes, and conditions which are used to separate them on the gel. The next slide, number 28, just compares a piece of ribotyping gel with a pulse field gel. And you can see that the ribotyping gel, particularly at the top of it, has rather slightly blurred fragments, and you don't get the same sort of effect on the pulse field gel. Now, that piece of ribotyping gel is, in fact, I think, quite a good example of one. And you can see about a third of the way along from the left-hand end, there are three strains, type 3, column side, three tracks side by side to indicate that those three strains are very similar. But if you wanted to know how similar they were, we would then have to put them on a pulse field gel to investigate further. I chose that particular pulse field gel. It's again quite a good example. It shows a lot of strains, virtually all the strains on that gel, apart from which the ones which look vaguely similar, are MRSA-15s. So you can see many differences between the different strains. There is one about a third of the way along from the left, which has one particular band missing about halfway down the gel. There are other tracks on that gel are in fact strains which are put in there as standard, so we can compare things more easily from gel to gel. That's just the summary, if you like, of different kinds of gel methods. And I want to now spend just a couple of minutes talking about the kind of problems you get with interpretation of gel results. I've already hinted that standardization is important and quite difficult, and it may well be difficult to say that in doing what appears to be the same technique in different laboratories may well give you results which are not directly comparable. And even between different gels in the same lab, you may find to look for small differences, you may want to repeat it so you've got the two strains you're interested in on the same gel. The second problem concerns working out which differences between strains are actually significant. A few years ago, Fritanova from CDC was one of the leading authors on a paper which discussed this point in some detail and put forward some criteria for deciding whether the number of how many bands had to be different before you could say that strains were different. I think most of us who use Pass Beyond a lot would say that those are perfectly reasonable ways of saying what is the defining the number of genetic events which must be involved in the change. But most of us say who use things a lot say it would get a very strong feeling from analyzing local strains, local epidemiology, that smaller differences are quite often significant. And the more you have to do this way of having local expert interpretation, the less portable your methods become, the less, in some ways, they become less useful to people who are actually using them from day to day if they have to be interpreted by experts. And again, in the same way, as I indicated, it's quite difficult to give you a useful description of a phage typing pattern. It may well be quite difficult to find a useful way of describing and designating patterns on a gel. Use of the increased standardization and computerized analysis are overcoming a lot of these difficulties, and there are several different attempts in different organisms to get international standard using a lot of organizational cooperation, and PulseNet is a very good example of that. Go on to the last section of this talk, which is on sequence-based typing. Sequence-based typing is certainly the most recently developed. It's developed really to try and get round some of the problems which derived from the other methods. It tends to be an automatable process. It's actually finding the base sequence, the base of the genes which of certain genes. It's an automatable process done on a machine. The computer analysis is necessary, and because of the way it's done, comparison between labs becomes much more easy than it is with the gel-based methods. It's much more expensive at present, and to some extent you can choose your level of discrimination by which genes you actually sequence. If you want coarse discrimination, then you look at a large number of stable genes, and that will help you to look at the long-term evolutionary trends. For fine discrimination infesting outbreaks, then you may want to look at fewer genes, but more variable ones. Slide 31 just summarizes information about multi-locus sequence typing. This is used for investigating, say, the longer-term trends. You get the sequence of seven housekeeping genes. The colored graph just to the top right of that picture just shows the kind of output that the machine produces. On the bottom right, the kind of sequence of digits which that is translated into, and the final illustration on that page is the home page of a website which helps us to, which basically keeps a database of all the different types for a number of different strains. Systems have been developed for many clinically important bacteria, including Staph aureus. Huge numbers of Staph aureocytes are typed, so MNST is, you can't be used for all of them. In fact, it's not very useful in investigating outbreaks. For example, all the MRSA15s are going to be the same. It's been used quite widely for Neisseria meningitidis and streptococcal pneumonia and quite a number of other isolates. These are things need a centrally maintained database, and this, of course, requires central funding, central organization. I will skip on to the next slide, where single gene sequence typing is cheaper because it uses less sequencing. It has many of the advantages of MNST in that the results are available in several different, results from different laboratories are highly easily comparable. It can be automated, and you generally use it for fine discrimination than MNST, and therefore you use a more variable gene, such as the PORE gene in meningococci or the SPAR gene in Staph aureus. And I think the value of these kind of typing methods is still to be proven, but I suspect that over the next few years they will become to be seen to be very important indeed. Just a couple, to finish with, a couple of slides producing comments on particular problems. I've already suggested that it's much easier to pick out that Staph aureus, one particular pastillon type, accounts for a very high proportion of all the strains we see, and the similar thing is true for Staminate enterogitis. And I think it's worth pointing out that this may well not reflect just that we haven't got the right typing method, but that you've got the early spread of a successful lineage. There is actually not enough diversity there to use for typing. The final comment is that no available typing method is so good that you can take its results if they don't make sense epidemiologically. If the on-the-ground epidemiology doesn't agree with the typing method, then don't assume that either one of them is automatically right. Think again. In other words, you need to understand both the typing and the underlying epidemiology. And if you don't know enough to look at both yourself, then ask somebody else who does, and you'll find a conversation between the epidemiologist and the person doing the typing may well shed a lot of light on an otherwise difficult problem. I'm afraid I've had to rush a bit at the end there, but that is everything I wanted to say. Thank you for listening.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Edwards, for that excellent presentation, despite what sounds to be a rather nasty cold. Thank you very much for soldiering through. Our next teleclass is a week from today, and will feature Dr. Elizabeth Bryce in a topic that she is calling Hospital Disaster Planning for Unusual Communicable Diseases, It Could Happen to You. And on April 20th, Dr. Lynn Seeholster of the CDC will present Environmental Infection Control in Healthcare Facilities, and she will report on a recent CDC guideline for healthcare hygiene. My thanks again to Dr. Edwards for an excellent presentation, and thank you to all of you for joining us on this call today. Until we meet again, stay safe. Goodbye.